All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Any public comments? Looks like we have a interesting series of presentations, so I won't, I don't have any major chairman's comments, so why don't we start with the presentations? I guess we'll start with suicide prevention initiative.
That would be me. All right, I do not have a PowerPoint. I know you guys are so disappointed with that, right? You can look at my smiling face or my public nerd face. I am a definite public health nerd. Reason being, I've been here for 17 years. I was in Green Bay years before this and love what I do. Suicide prevention, a lot of people say, you know what, you're probably depressed all the time when you do this stuff. Actually, it's very fulfilling. Love helping people, hooking up with services. It's a great opportunity that we've had here in Kenosha. Unfortunately, our funding is on at the end of the year here. So what we're gonna do, I'm not really sure. We're still looking for other opportunities, and I think a lot of the things that we have done will continue, whether it's through the health department here or it's other partners that we've made through our coalition. I did give you a handout. I'm not gonna go through that. It's just giving you some numbers of what it looks like, suicide would look like here in Kenosha, methods that are most popular, the age ranges, those type of things. But what I wanna more or less concentrate on is, you know, why I do what I do. I don't know if you guys know that I do have a personal background with suicide. I lost my friend Jim to suicide 30 years ago. It was when I was a sophomore in high school. He was a senior. Jim was a very popular gentleman. He played football, well-liked, goofed around all the time, made us crack up in Spanish class all the time. And when he died, I was watching The Breakfast Club. I will never watch that movie again. It was just became popular. I'm on Facebook, and it popped up on my news feed, like, hey, that's the anniversary. And I'm like, oh, I hate that movie. And again, I don't even remember it. But it just left that bad taste in my mouth because it reminds me of the day I found out that he died. Survivors are one of the best parts of my job. I love working with survivors, although I wish we didn't have to, because there's so much devastation left behind after a person has died by suicide. And some of you may have experienced that as well. Since Jim's death, I've also lost two other friends. High school friends, one I went to grade school with, all through grade school and high school, and then another gentleman that took his life after high school as well. So it's very personal to me, and I'm very passionate about it, so that's why, again, I feel like I fit in with this whole public health nerd thing. I want you guys to take away a couple things today. What can you do? Everybody thinks that, you know, there's nothing I can do to prevent suicide. Knowing what the warning signs are, huge. That's one of the things that we talk to survivors about, because they don't always know what the signs are, and they miss it sometimes, so then they feel guilty. Why didn't I see that? I should have known. But knowing those things, like if people are talking about death, drawing about it, listening to music about it, those type of things, that will clue you into that. If a person is withdrawing, that's another sign for it. If they're giving away prized possessions, if they suddenly seem happy and they've been depressed for a long time, that might mean they've made that decision and they know that the end is near and that they're going to be happy soon, or that's how they see it. There are other signs as well, but educate yourself and educate others, people that you work with, your friends and family, because the more people that know about it, the more likely they are going to stop it. We do QPR trainings here in Kenosha. We started out with just me being the only person that was trained. We went to having four other people trained. Those people, I think, have kind of dropped off, but now we have 10 people. We have had, in 2008 is when we did this QPR training. It stands for question, persuade, refer. It teaches people how to question if a person is suicidal. It teaches them how to persuade them to get help and then get to refer them to the help that they need. We had trained about 1,300 people the first 3 years. Since then, we have done additional 5,500 people. So we've trained almost 7,000 people in QPR. and again, with about 10 different instructors. And we have hit the middle schools. The high schools are very popular with this training, and they have really, it's really been well received. We've had, one school is notorious that the minute we do this presentation, there's like 5 to 10 kids that just pop up out of there and say, I need to talk. And it could either trigger something or they've been wanting to talk about it but didn't know how to bring it up. So that's been something very productive in this grant. I also want to encourage people to tell their story. So if you have a story, if you have a loved one that you've lost to suicide, please tell. Know what setting works. It's not something you're going to just suddenly bring up. But we always tell the survivors, tell your story. Your loved one did exist. We want to remember them for their life and not their death. And that's important to do. On the way up to my car, I found a dime. Okay, and people are like, oh yeah, what do we do? You know, I'm rich now, right? But what that means to me is that reminds me of a survivor. He told me a story that whenever he gets lonely thinking about his son, he tends to find dimes. One day he was mowing his grass and he had to stop because there was a big pile of like sticks and things like that. He found a pile of dimes there after his son had passed. So there's little reminders, obviously, that our loved ones are still around, but again, we want to remember them for their life and not for death. So today I was smiling and I was thinking of Cordero today because of that dime. Never underestimate the power of positivity that you guys can have too. If you see somebody that's down, ask them, how are you? What's going on? Is there something I can help? Because I've done that in our commons area. I've had a gentleman sit there one day, he looked like he had lost his best friend. And I started walking. I was going to a meeting, one of our staff meetings. And I was like, I can't keep walking. I have to ask this guy what's going on. I said to him, how are you? He just looked at me. And I said, is it okay if I sit down for a minute? You don't like that. So I sat down. And I said, would you like to talk? Didn't say anything to me for the longest time. And I said, you know what? I'm going to sit here until you're ready to talk, unless you tell me to go away. He sat there. Okay. Finally, he said to me, he goes, you have a cigarette? I said, no, but I could find you one. I know we don't want to encourage that, but I figured this might open up the doorway. So I did find him a cigarette. We went outside. That man started talking. I just moved here. I have some mental health issues. I need a job. I can't see my kids. He just opened up and started talking. So we came back inside, and I said, what are you here for? And you had an appointment. And so I said, why don't you see that appointment and then come back and find me. I'm upstairs. Otherwise, tell somebody in the building that that's who you want to see. Gathered some resources for him. The man's demeanor changed dramatically from just me sitting there and talking to him. I missed our staff meeting, and I made sure everybody knew. But I thought that was more important at the time. If I wouldn't have taken that time, I don't know what would have happened. I'm not saying I saved that man's life, but just to spend that little bit of time with him made him feel wanted, needed, and again, he got the services that he needs. Talked about QPR. We also do lots of means restriction here. We are known for our means restriction strategies, and the state looks to us for that. We've given out cable gun locks. It's so hard to keep track of how many we've given out. Yeah, our supply of 6,000 is almost gone, but we don't always get the data back. But people are using them. They're welcoming them to make sure that they lock up their guns. We have people giving the message, keep your guns unloaded, locked up, and your ammunition stored separately. Therefore, people can't get into them and possibly take their lives. A child will find it accidentally, those type of things. With our medicine drop boxes, just this past 6 months, we've collected over 2,300 pounds of unused medication. Since we've been doing it in 2012, we've collected over 11,000 pounds. Okay, so that's a lot of medicines that we're not using in our community, but could have gone into the water or into the soil. And then we have our medicine lock boxes that we give free of charge. We've given out 140 of them so far. We would have given out a lot more, but we just got our shipment in. We've had a little bit of an issue with the supplier being able to give them to us. But those things are all helping, again, our community to be a little bit safer. We have our survivors of suicide support group. I did leave a flyer there. If you guys have a place to post it, if you have somebody to give that to. Encourage people to come if they are a survivor, and meaning that they've lost a loved one to suicide, not that they've attempted and survived. That group lets people know that they're not alone, and it helps them to talk about their feelings. They stop asking why after a while. That's the biggest question that we get. Why did my loved one take their life? I was right here. I was helping them. And this just lets them know that other people ask that too. And it's okay to ask it, but you're probably never going to get the answer to it. We have our college advisory board, where the colleges, the mental health professionals, and the ERs meet, and they talk, and they share resources, so that we know that if a college student goes to the hospital, that they can come back to college and kind of re-enter without incident. That's what we're trying to provide. Our coalition is going strong. It's been going since 2006. We meet every month except July and November, and we have 12 to 15 people that still attend each meeting. SDIRT, Gianna works on that project, and that is an adult death review team. We review suicides as well as drug overdoses. And when we review those, we try to find out, was there anything we could have done differently? Did that person, were they hooked up with services and just maybe dropped off? Were they never hooked up with services? Are there other categories or populations that we could be addressing to alleviate some of these deaths that are occurring? We've also done a ton of trainings. We have brought AMSR training, which is assessing and managing suicide risk. We also brought a CALM training, which is counseling to access to lethal means. We are bringing additional training. We are doing a vet summit. We are going to do another clergy summit. We are going to do suicide bereavement clinician training, because our survivors have given us some feedback that when they go to see a provider, a lot of times they don't always know how to work with them. We've had a survivor say that the one clinician told her that her son was selfish for taking his life. That's not the right thing to say at all. So that person was bold enough to go home and then get on the phone and say, that wasn't correct. You need to educate yourself as to what you're telling people. And that clinician did apologize and said, you're right, I absolutely need more training. They get very little training, but yet that's one of the most common things, grief and suicide are things that mental health providers see. And then we also have a survivor workshop that's coming up. So lots of things going on still. I mean, the next 6 months, we're gonna pack in as much as we possibly can. We've got some money to spend down. But again, we want this to continue on and be able to make sure that the suicides don't increase in our community. If anybody has any questions, I'll open it up to that. I just wanted to keep it short, since I'm short.
I just have a really quick, cool story. Several years ago, my sister-in-law was over at my house speaking to my wife, and she said, boy, we caught Jamie, her daughter was 16 at the time, cutting herself. That's what goes on in school nowadays. These kids are all doing this kind of stuff. And I said, wait a minute, right, huge red flag. This could lead to suicide. And they just looked at me and I said, you gotta report this to somebody like right away. I said, this is a huge indicator. And my sister-in-law was just kind of blown off. No, all the kids are doing it. And at the time I was there was a CASA program, court appointed special advocate. I said, you know, I just heard you say this, I'm a mandatory reporter. You'd report this tomorrow to the school council, or I have to. So they did, and she's still alive today. But yeah, she's 20 something now. But exactly, it just something is cutting. And if I wouldn't have heard about that, I don't know, years on the county board or being on this board, and just having these booklets available, I've given these out a few times. It's one in my car now. It's always one in my journal. These booklets are great.
Good. Thank you for sharing that.
Other questions?
Where does Kenosha rank as far as cities in Wisconsin?
They don't. They'll never put it on a map like you're number one, you're number two, because it can be good for funding, but then it can also be not so good. I would say we're probably in the top 10. Some of the rural communities, like up north, they will have, let's say, a 5 in a year, but that's horrible because of the population, so if we're looking at rates. But we've really cut down on teen suicides here. That's one of the positive things. Obviously, if we lose anybody, it's not a positive thing. But middle-aged men were still very much struggling with. This year, we seem to be the late 20s and 30s are the deaths that we're seeing the most. This year, we already have 6 confirmed, 2 pending. So, and unfortunately, the ones that there's some relationship to of the deaths. So it gets frustrating. But I would say still in the top 10 probably in the state.
Do they feel, Cindy, that this will continue? If we're in the top 10%?
Well,
how does that figure in?
When we keep looking at this root cause, and so trying to have the availability of mental health resources and access to care available, and in Kenosha County, we're looking at how do we solve that problem with the shrinking number of psychiatrists that are available, looking at other means. We're in discussion of looking at telepsychiatry, possibility of nurse practitioners that have specialties in psychiatry. So it's a whole access to care, and then reducing that stigma so people do access care. So that's more of trying to do the prevention and get people the care that they need so we can reduce those rates and numbers.
Mm-hmm. And I neglected to introduce Gianna. Gianna Ventura is one of the public health nurses that work with me on the project, so. Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for supporting this effort. And again, if you just say one thing to one person, you never know if it could make that difference. I have pens for you guys too. I should have done that so you could write down all that important information I just gave you. But if you ever need it again, feel free to give me a call and I'd be happy to share that with you. So. And I also have bracelets, too, that have the text line number. We are real into promoting that. It's not only good for teens, but it's good for adults, too. You can call anytime you want by texting, obviously. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, text HOPELINE to 741-741, and somebody will answer you. And that has been so popular with, like I said, the teens, but you'd be amazed at how many older adults are using it these days. So this one doesn't work, so I will get you one. It's not retracting, so thank you again.
Thank you. Now the Kenosha Light Corps.
That would be me. Good afternoon. My name is Pamela Smith, project coordinator for the Kenosha Life Collaborative, which began in 2010 here with the health department. So I'm going to do a quick recap, and if we are challenged by Deb's report to think about death by suicide, we are equally challenged in thinking about death by infant mortality. And that is the purpose of our collaborative, which is made up of about 30 different local organizations here, which changes from time to time with leadership. But our purpose is to reduce and prevent African American infant mortality and thereby infant mortality overall. Our collaborative was started in 2010, just as a recap, around 3 work groups based on Dr. Michael Liu's work on the Life Course approach to health disparities. And those consist of 3 work groups: access to healthcare, strengthening communities and families, and then addressing social and economic inequities, which are the prongs of the Life Course that our collaborative have been working on. We have moved to being led by our partners and members at one time for the first few years. The staff and convening agency here at the Health Department led the collaborative as co-chairs along with the Kenosha Community Health Center executive director, past executive director. And now that has changed. So we rotate through our co-chairs of these work groups who are our collaborative partner organization, and they rotate and lead and facilitate the meetings, which is a huge buy-in and a real capacity builder for the collaborative. Membership is 31%. Social service agencies, 23% of us are public health, 12% HMOs, 11% faith, based organizations. We've got about a quarter of the folks coming from Kenosha Unified or affiliate programs, and then faith-based local government and businesses. Our goals and objectives for this year, they change each year. We're funded for 5 years. The current funding is from 2015 to 2019, but each year we have to go back and do an interim report and report on our outcomes and progress. Cindy and Glenn and I and Cheryl just came back from a presentation last Friday in Madison to our funders to review some of this, and I've drilled that down to just a few slides here for you today. So for this year, we wanted to reorganize from that staff and agency, public health department, leading the collaborative to engaging our members to do that. We wanted new stakeholders. We picked up the Kenosha Housing Authority and Boys and Girls Club, and a few other newbies are at the table. And then we conducted a full-year environmental scan. And you may remember when I was here last year, I talked about conducting that scan, and the two priorities that came up were depression during pregnancy and postpartum, so access to mental health services for pregnant and postpartum women, and then implementing a navigator position. Second, by the way, in those priorities was housing. So we're just starting to talk with the Kenosha Housing Authority about how we may identify and address some issues that are affecting families and impacting their health. So the additional strategies that we came up with around mental health and housing were to create a referral network so that not only the women and families involved with our health department home visiting programs, that's the HV, home visiting referral network, but that we would now broaden that reach so that any woman who enters the system will have access to receiving therapy and referrals and screenings for depression. So for our work plan for this coming year, we are entering year three this year. We got approved to hire a community health navigator to help assist women on the front end with accessing mental health services. That position was just posted along with our mental health coordinator position, and those two will work closely together now to engage more women. And I think the CDC recommended universal depression screenings with a couple of tools, and so we're hoping to engage more providers in administering the depression screening tools. We have a Women's Health and Emotional Wellness Summit on the books for September. September is National Infant Mortality Awareness Month, and we will be bringing in our faculty director of the LIFE projects from UW-Madison. She's also clinic director there at OBGYN, so she will be coming down to speak as well as others. We've had great success every year with our diaper drive and have not only supplied directly to the moms who sign up at the agencies and come, but then we have resourced the WIC office, the outreach center over at ELCA, and then also PSN with the diapers that are collected. That was made possible also by $3,250 that we were able to raise through our HMOs who donated for that purpose. And then we want to connect more with other coalitions. There are many coalitions, as Deb just reported, on the Suicide Prevention Coalition, and you might think that's a test for how well you know your acronyms up there, but the Early Childhood Comprehensive System, which I work on along with Dr. Gerlach, is addressing trauma and ACEs and the impact of some of that work, taking a look on at how we can maybe collaborate in more, because we are attending those. Healthy People Kenosha County, the Evangelical Lutheran Congregational Association, our Fetal Infant Mortality Review Committee, which Gianna also heads up along with the Child Death Review, and then Emergency Services Network. So we'll know by our benchmarks if we've been able to achieve our goals by getting someone on board as a navigator, community health navigator, convening our summit, exploring with Cindy Zarletti, who has been attending our meetings from the Kenosha Housing Authority, and then increasing membership and participation there. Also looking at the outcomes from year two. We have had some success, as I mentioned, with restructuring and expanding our leadership capacity. So there's some anticipation of succession training there. Our membership increased from 22 to 26. So we've got quite a crowd that convenes monthly. 11 new members, 2 new sectors, and we continue to do outreach at the WIC office. We have a Kenosha Life outreach office where we rent space at the WIC office, and we average seeing about 42 contacts each quarter there, along with our involvement with the Fathers Program. The last one, let me go back. I don't know if that's, see if you can get that to work. That's the handout. Mr. O'Day mentioned that when we came in, that this might be an interesting exercise in trying to follow the lines. But one of the things we were asked when we went to Madison to present is, what difference has the collaborative made in Kenosha? And what difference has the $150,000 for 5 years made in convening the collaborative? So we came back and put this together. Basically, if you go to your left of the red area, the peach color is all the programs that the Kenosha Life Collaborative have initiated in the peach area. And 3 of those were funded with additional dollars from the Wisconsin Partnership Program, that being the WIC Father Involvement Program, Healthy Families Kenosha, which is completing its 3rd year funding this year with the Prevention Services Network, and then the Dismantling Racism Committee, which we did not put on here. I need to put that on here. But that finished after its first year. And then all of this emerged. You know, we were able to tell the people in Madison that Kenosha's interest and efforts around infant mortality did not start with funding from WPP, but it started back in 88 and 95 and 08 with CORE and some of the other earlier initiatives, including the infant mortality delegation that grew out of the United Way. All of this preceded life and have been part of the infrastructure here and commitment to addressing this issue over the years. So we were able to present this in diagram form, and it's being used in Madison by our state lead to present to the funders in another week or so. So we continue to do the work and address the issues and try to look at how we can now address this issue of postpartum depression and during pregnancy and postpartum for the women and children that have been served here in Kenosha. So that is the Life Course Initiative that I have.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have one question related to this diagram.
Sure.
For coordinated response to infant and child deaths. Is that something different than CORE, which is coordinated response to child abuse and neglect?
Go ahead.
It's supposed to be, isn't it the CORE coordinated response to abuse and neglect? Isn't that the CORE that we're seeing?
I'm wondering if this is something different, because I'm guessing it's probably supposed to be the same thing. So you might just want to change that on your diagram.
Okay, I'll follow
what
up.
What does it say?
To core response to infant and child deaths.
And it should be child abuse and neglect.
It's abuse and, it's abuse and neglect. So we'll just take a look at it again and see if there's any language change. There's such a multitude of programs.
That's why I wanted to confirm that
it
wasn't the same one.
Yeah, we'll check with Maya, because she actually does most of the grant writing and historical stuff, and that came out of some work that she did. So I don't think it ever was directed for, was it always for child abuse and neglect?
I think it was, and I believe though that probably child fatality was sort of housed within that initially when it was first developed. So that's why, now, of course, we have two separate teams, but I'm just curious if that's maybe where that came from, because they did probably handle that initially.
Thank you.
The core group then went to the National Training for Child Death Review that occurred here in Wisconsin. That was quite a few years ago, back in the 90s.
Well, we're sure we want to get it correct before we start disseminating it publicly, so I'll check. We'll make sure we get that accurate.
Thanks,
thank you.
Peter.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
It's good work that you're doing with getting the education out. Ever since I've been involved with the Home Center and the homeless population, there's a certain percentage of those that are living in poverty that need an extreme amount of education and help and
yeah.
information.
Yeah, I've recently started attending the ESN meetings mm-hmm. With the Shalom Center director, also giving some stats. So mm-hmm. there's so much overlap to all
exactly.
of these issues. So
thank
you. Thank you. Appreciate that.
School nursing services program.
I'm going to stand because I think everybody stand. I think that's okay. So I'm Bridget Cardelli. I'm the team lead for the school nurses, which Jana is also on that team. Check of all trades here. So the staffing for our team consists of 9 school nurses. That's not 9 full-time school nurses. It's actually a 4.5 because we share responsibilities with other grants. We're able to have them there for 40 hours, but their time delegated to schools might be less than that, which increases their availability to their schools. So it works out really well on both ends. The ratio of school nurses is 1 to 3,598 students. That's their caseload. And it ranges from anywhere from 2 schools up to 7 schools per nurse. Very recently, the American Academy of Pediatrics wrote a really nice article kind of praising school nurses and how we're needed. So I didn't redo what they wrote about our job description because I feel like they hit the nail right on the head. So it's school nurses provide surveillance, chronic disease management, emergency preparedness, behavioral assessment, ongoing health education, and extensive case management. Kind of spells it out pretty well for us. A large part of that is done through emergency health plans. And that's a written plan on each student individually based on what their condition is. It's heavily, takes up most of our time between August and November. It's phone calls to parents, it's coordinating the meetings, making sure the parents come to the table along with staff members, the school members that are going to be taking care of their student throughout the day, and make sure that, what does this child's day look like? What does he need? Does he need time out of class? How is he going to catch up? Working through things like that. Also figuring out who actually encounters that student can sometimes be finding a needle in a haystack. They have a schedule, but yet well, they go to speech and then they have a tutor that comes in with them. So trying to find out exactly what that student does during the day can be part of the differences of making that plan. The number of plans that we do kind of changes as our seniors graduate and maybe take along with them some conditions, and the 4K kids coming in might not have as much, and that could vary from year to year, as you can see. So this is the latest information. We just finished our year collecting our data. So this very last year for number of healthcare plans is 911, and it kind of varies through. So that's 911 care plans written by those 9 nurses. Medications also goes along with care plans, so a very large part of what we do throughout the day. Training and educating staff on the medication administration. It's not just oral meds, sometimes it's ear drops, eye drops, pink eye. We have to have that drop 4 times a day, so we have to train them on how to give those eye drops. Injections, inhaled, emergency medications versus daily medications, or just over-the-counter medications as well. So we review what comes in, the medication looks like the order was written for it, make sure that it makes sense. There's times we've had to call the pharmacy and say, do you realize what you wrote is not on the bottle, and we just want to make sure this is what we're supposed to give and mistakes have been caught. So we're kind of that safety net to make sure that all works out. Overnight field trips, as school nurses, we'd like to cancel all field trips. We see their value, but they drive us nuts. So we're always happy when they came back and everybody's good and accounted for. So the number of students receiving, and this is just daily medications, those are the ADHD, seizure meds, different types of meds that they might have to have throughout the day at school. We do see an increase in those morning medications. being given her feeding kids breakfast. Do they have to have that ever all with something in their stomach, and a cracker doesn't cut it? So a lot of kids, we do see that they're receiving the medications at school in the morning. So if there's behavioral issues where they don't trust that the parent is consistently giving it, counselors will come to us and beg us to give the daily medication in the morning so that they know it's being given, it's consistent. And even seizure medications, unfortunately, you know, we've had kids who have seizures throughout the day, and doctors have called us and said, we just want to make sure that they're getting it. And we know if the school is giving it, they are getting it. So daily medications has increased. That number, that little bar there, was actually from December, and it should be just below the 350 right now. So I don't know if I can work my red thing there, but I think it's about there that it's supposed to be. And that was from June. So from December to June, we probably had another 100-150 or so medications, daily medications added on. Staff trainings, that starts in August. We really try to hit them really good before they start getting the students in and getting their attention. So we're training them the 2 weeks before school starts with meetings on how to manage diabetic cares throughout the day, anaphylaxis and EpiPen injections, seizures, how to manage them safely, and Diastat, which is a rectal suppository that several of our students with seizures also has at school. Asthma management, what that looks like, what's the teacher's responsibility. I believe it's like 1 in 15 kids has asthma, and I'm off the top of my head. So that, I mean, if you've got 30 kids in your classroom, chances are pretty strong you're going to have at least one with asthma, and being able to recognize those symptoms. A lot of our kiddos with asthma are used to it. They're used to not breathing. They're used to trying to just fly under the radar and not be noticed. So having teachers or any staff member keyed into what that looks like is really beneficial to our students with asthma. Teaching them the Heimlich maneuver, they eat in the classroom. They have parties and snacks. It's not just in the lunchroom. And Fridays, they eat in the classroom as well, because they're, you know, trying to save money and not have the lunchroom staff, so that has changed to kids eating into their classroom one day a week. State mandated medication administration training is required by law that they have to redo that every 4 years. And Kenosha Unified asked us to collaborate with them to develop that training tool. There's one online that they could have done, but it was very cumbersome, and this way they can track it with their staff members. And even though state mandates every 4 years, Kenosha Unified mandates every year that all new employees get it. So that one's, it's a very lengthy training program for them to go through how to give medications, but that way they're trained for field trips and other things that come up. What the general population for our KUSD students looks like. We have 16,000 plus students that we care for. Of those, 2,308 students have 5 of the most common health conditions. Another 400, I believe it is, has other health conditions that don't quite fit into that, that I wouldn't even be able to list off the top of my head, but there's 90 kind of more rare, less common health conditions that we have to help them maneuver their school day. So we had, that was an old number when I first did it, new numbers came in, so it's up to 911 students with emergency health care plans this year. So that's the number of health concerns overall. So it's about 2,700 kids that have some type of health condition that they're battling throughout their day. I included this one because asthma has always kind of been an interesting one for me. So we collect who has asthma and who has emergency medications with them at school. That means if they're having trouble breathing, they can get a hold of their inhaler throughout the day. So that large gap there between the dark green and the light green, our kids with asthma, they don't have an emergency inhaler. And we all kind of went, huh, we kind of want to figure out what that group looks like. Do they need an inhaler? Are their parents telling us they have asthma when actually they had a nebulizer when they were 2 and they never really had asthma and they've grown out of it? So what does that look like? So this year we started collecting data, and I don't have that all for you. But I think that we'll see that we were able to reduce the number of kids that we believe have asthma because parents have told us it's no longer a diagnosis. It was, you know, something that we got inhaler from the emergency room for a cough 4 years ago. Maybe they don't have asthma. But then we were also able to educate each person that we talked to, each parent, that, well, do you realize that for gym class, they run the mile within the first month? And if your kid has asthma and they want to be able to run, they need their inhaler that day. They, you know, will have a pacer test that most kids with asthma are the ones in my office throwing up after they force themselves to do this pacer test because you think, well, they really only need it for soccer. So we actually were able to increase our number of inhalers that came in. And I'm sorry, I don't have any of this for you. It was small, but it was something. We were actually really excited once we got, if we got 4 inhalers in one school, we were doing a happy dance. So Another big part, especially this time of year, is medication disposal. So once we get all those meds in and we're able to take care of those kids all year long, we want parents to come back and get them. And they don't always make it in. So tomorrow we're going to dispose of all the medication that was not collected. It takes up time. We're sending letters, we're making phone calls, reminding parents to come and get them. And each school, there's 37 schools, takes up at least 1 to 2 hours of our time to gather the medications, prepare them for disposal, recording what we're disposing of, zeroing out their infinite campus is their electronic system that keeps track of those meds, so we have to go in and zero out all the medications at the end of the year. And then we combine them all together. This is what we used to do at the end of the year. We used to stand over a toilet and flush. This was probably 10 years ago. That would take up a little bit of time. So we don't do that anymore. Instead, this is what it looks like. We collect all the pills all together. We scratch off the names so we can dispose of the containers, and we put the medications in a Ziploc bag so we can use the disposal at our sites. And the reason is in order to prevent pollution. We're not sending those medications toilet anymore into the garbage where it can pollute our environment or poisonings. If these medications go home with these kids and they're sitting there and nobody's noticed that that's come home with them, someone accidentally getting into them. And then of course drug abuse, especially with our daily medications for ADHD, we don't want to see those being used for any reason other than ADHD. So that's school nursing in a very small nutshell. Any questions?
I'm surprised ADHD didn't make the list of some of the top.
We actually, because it does require a lot of our time under medications, but it doesn't require a lot of our time as far as writing a care plan. Kids with ADHD get a plan from their teacher, an IEP.
No, I mean this, from the student population, that the 5 most prevalent health conditions in ADHD.
It probably is, but
we don't
record it.
Oh, you don't record it.
For
okay.
Health condition for what we have to help manage. So
do you know what percentage of families that you're actually giving the meds because it's not like people give them at home? Between
that
your
we would admit to.
Population.
I know of myself, I have 7 schools, and it's probably in your the schools that you would guess that mm-hmm. have, you know, less parent involvement. I have 2 students right now that have, one has an ADHD and one has a seizure med that it has been mandated. So I would bet each nurse probably has at least 1 or 2.
Yeah.
So probably 15, 20 kids.
Okay.
No. And the school really does try to put that back on the parent, because if we continue to enable them, it never goes back. So we do try. And each year that they come back, we ask them, how are things going? You know, do you have a plan? And as the student gets older, sometimes they can take that responsibility back once they're in middle school or high school.
Thank you.
Any
other questions? Great. Thank you. I have a few things to update everybody. First of all, I want to thank the presenters. They did a great job. Thank you for sharing your programs. Right now, as we speak, we're initiating our full-scale exercise. The simulated medication is crossing the border, and Stacey Wines is videographing the truck with the medication, supposed medication, around just south of 165 on Highway 94 with at the weigh station, or the weight station. So that's where they were going to do the transition with our law enforcement. So we're the mass clinic exercise is today and tomorrow. It's already started. We'll have our pod, which is our clinic, mass clinic at UW Parkside. That'll be held tomorrow in the morning. We have about 50 people who volunteered already to go through the line, and they'll be simulated given the antibiotic. This is an anthrax release is what this exercise entails. And so we're gearing up for how we would manage that in our community to protect all of our residents with the antibiotics. We had our healthcare executive roundtable meeting that was held June 1st, and we had an individual from the American Heart Association who presented. We had a nice group of people that were there from our committee. We're up to 46 members on the healthcare executive roundtable meeting. The health department has applied for Medicaid meaningful use. Those of you that are providers are familiar with that. That initiative through CMS, it's... our data supports the threshold to meet meaningful use. And if we're accepted into the meaningful use program, we will bring a return of $63,000 over the next 5 years as revenue back to the health department just for initiating that program. It's a seed money to start meaningful use in an organization. Our environmental team, we're conducting a mosquito collection project with the state. So we'll have about 20 solo cups with a tongue blade in them with a small amount of water, and those little mosquitoes lay their eggs on that tongue blade, and we'll send it off to the state to see if we have Zika or what type of mosquitoes that we have here. Our license renewals have been sent out. We're doing beach sampling throughout, and we've added two county parks, Silver Lake Park and Old Settlers Park. So this alleviates the work for our parks department in the county that we're not duplicating. We're out in that area anyway, so we'll do the collection at those two parks. And the environmental team, they are on their summer inspection for all the events that go on the weekend, so they're on weekend detail. So summer vacations for them aren't as easy. Our nursing division, we do have a probable Zika case. We're waiting for confirmation through the CDC, and it usually takes about 2 to 4 weeks to see if that is an actual case. Our medication-assisted treatment program, which Gianna coordinates, we're serving about 32 clients that are in various tiers of the program. 19 of those are given and have been given injections, or 19 injections have been given. Our pertussis cases are declining, thank goodness. We started that uptick late last fall. Our electronic health record system just went live with the Wisconsin Immunization Registry System. So we were able to coordinate that integration of those two systems. A group went to Washington, D.C., it was Boston. They attended the National Home Visitation called COIN meeting, and it was by invitation. Last week, we were invited to speak through the Results for America panel about our home visitation program through the Nurse Family Partnership. The Results for America panel is based out of Washington, D.C., and they promote evidence-based practices using federal funds. And Speaker Ryan was awarded a plaque for his work on poverty and support of evidence-based programs. We are in process of doing our community health needs assessment. We last did that in 2014, and now we are working on a 2016 survey. There's usually about 400 telephone surveys that are conducted through this health assessment. We're working with Aurora Health Center, United Hospital System, and Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Those three organizations provide the funds to do this survey, and the cost is about $18,000. So we're very grateful to the partners of those entities to support our community health needs assessment. As Pam mentioned, we did our year two of 5 year summary report. Pam had to defend her project to a panel of reviewers at the state in Madison for the state medical program, and it was quite a deal. We not all of our grant projects do we have to defend our project in such a manner with an oral presentation, not only an extensive summary report, but also an oral presentation. And they review us, and then we'll get feedback on that, and they also offer some insight as to our progress. Also, Pam mentioned about the Dismantling Racism program. We had a contingent that presented to Southeastern Regional leadership in the Milwaukee area. When Adeline Green, Pam, did you attend?
No, I didn't. Those were the only two I was aware of.
Okay, I think there was the third person that went, and they presented to the group on the project of dismantling racism, which that project has since ended, although the efforts are working in a soft way through many, many integrations in our other programs and services. And lastly, I want to mention that our early childhood comprehensive system is providing a trauma training June 28th. It'll be here at the Job Center between 8 and 11. So
that it's secondary trauma.
Thank you.
So vicarious trauma is for people who are working in a field where they come in contact with it a lot. So it's about protecting yourself and your staff from the mental burnout.
Thank you for adding that detail. And just lastly, staffing. We're getting closer to filling all of our positions. We do have one public health nurse who is returning from Abbott. And yes, we're happy about that. So she's returning to her position with the Nurse Family Partnership Program, which is a huge plus for us because of the cost to educate the staff in that program. Remember, they go for a week in Colorado for their training. And so this is a huge plus, and we're very happy to have Sarah Merck's return from Abbott. She should be starting back in July. We had a public health nurse start today, and we'll be having a public health tech starting soon, and I think just mental health navigator and the mental health coordinator are still outstanding. And in the environmental section, one of our environmental public health techs moved up to be a sanitarian, and so now we have that tech position to fill. So we're getting closer to being all staff.
I have a quick question on Zika. So it's really a lot of people are starting to talk about it here in Wisconsin now. There are a couple of cases here already. It's not expected to come here by mosquito. I think you reported that last month. It's going to be from travel.
That's why we're doing mosquito tracking to see if mosquitoes are here, but mostly
that mosquito doesn't make it up this far.
Usually it's visitation into the areas that.
The question I have is, if I get it, or if you get it, how can it be transmitted from me to her or him? Is the answer yes or no?
That's what they're doing through their research, and potentially yes, through sexual contact.
Okay.
And that's what they're starting to see, that might be a potential, and there's still ongoing research.
Wasn't clear on that.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Florida last week, or 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. It's in the headlines every day. They're begging for emergency federal funding. I believe last week they didn't get it. Well, it was reported.
Yeah, that's.
Yeah, I mean, the economic and health impact down there in the South is going to be huge.
Right. The federal government is looking at our previous Ebola dollars that were remaining, any remaining or the leftover funds were going to be transferred over to Zika. I think that's still being wrangled out in Washington, D.C., so we're waiting to see if there's going to be additional preparedness dollars that are going to be added to our funds in order to support, or whether the dollars will be delegated to areas in the United States where they're really a hotbed. But there's still a lot of surveillance that's going on to see exactly where these mosquitoes are traveling. Like Dr. Rader, you went to some interesting conference around mosquitoes on Tuesday.
I was at a CE for Lyme disease, but the person that spoke from the human side, more from the veterinary side, but his lab is in across, and they're doing what you guys are doing up there. They're also talking about Lyme disease, as well as being pretty endemic in Wisconsin, and how there's such a lack of significant testing for humans. We have better testing on the veterinary side.
And a pet can carry the Zika virus?
Lyme's disease right now.
We don't know.
That's a whole nother,
yeah.
Because Zika is so new.
Yeah.
There's still so much research that's going on.
Yeah.
I don't know. Dr. Foster, Occupational Health, have you heard anything from your end to share? Or it's so new and fresh, and we're getting information on a regular basis. But ongoing new and emerging diseases, really communicable disease, still is on the forefront for public health. And we think we get one thing wrapped up, and then something new emerges, or pertussis or mumps or something else comes back, and then we're busy with that. So communicable disease definitely still prevalent. prevails.
The one potential case that you have here, is it a pregnant person or no?
Yes, and she moved here from another area to be with her significant partner, her husband on the picture, and so she relocated and she is pregnant. So that's the probable that we're waiting for confirmation. So I get, we're going to see a lot of these moving parts that are going on.
For this mass clinic exercise, mm-hmm. Is it something would be worth observing? I got time to
learn. That would be wonderful. And you might be asked,
I volunteered last month.
Do it again.
I volunteered last month to be a.
That would be great.
If they need to work, just at that 50.
No, they really were shooting for 100.
Oh, okay.
So because we're also timing the throughput to see how many people we can get through.
Okay.
And they'll be given a scenario that they'll read for their client, for their case, as
okay.
a client case. And so they'll be presenting themselves as different scenarios to the staff, and the staff then have to troubleshoot and still continue to give them the medication and the throughput and then ask to go through again. So we'll do that for a strong hour.
So what time,
and how
what,
many people?
What time and what building? Shoot me an email.
I will.
Yeah.
Karen, thank you. We'll get that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can be there. I got two retired brothers, may I bring them along?
Awesome, great. Make a day of it and have breakfast. And I think it's around 10:30, I would say, 10:30, 11:30, I think so, but we'll get you the details.
Yeah, just give me a
That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think that's great that you do that. And again, if you ever want to observe our programs, any of ours, I'm sure that's always open. And I would hope that, like, if we want to come to your place of business or, that would be also a possibility, because maybe there's some things that we could share with your staff or clients. That would be helpful as well. So please keep that in mind. That's very good.
Thanks, Debbie.
Corporation Council.
Not a lot. There was a meeting within the last month involving crisis, the sheriff's department, the police department, Wheaton Franciscan, or St. Luke's, if you will. The main issue there being communication between law enforcement and the hospital on Chapter 51 cases. Seemed like a productive meeting to handle that kind of communication within the ramifications of HIPAA and those types of regulations. I think we're going to be talking to other hospitals with whom Kenosha County contracts, because this has been there have been some issues with that. I also was involved in another meeting at Crisis where we talked about Alzheimer's and how well Kenosha County is doing and what we do and how we can do better. So that was a big meeting. I'm working with Health Department on at least one lead abatement case, and that's about all I have.
The other business is motion to adjourn.
Motion. Second.
Thank you.
Just figured I'd let you in.